Yes, we do have health insurance. My husband's on Medicare, and he also pays for a Humana supplemental policy. We pay for that. And I also have insurance through Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Are they any better than DakotaCare?
They're better. They're better in terms of premiums and copays and deductibles. But once you get to the point, it takes you years. It took us years to build what we had. We have six children. We raised six kids. And we have 13 grandchildren. And the humiliation of asking them to take us in their home to live because we couldn't make it anymore on our own was horrendous for everybody.
I have to ask, you said you had cancer. Is it in remission? How's your health?
Thank you for asking. I'm cancer-free at this time. And
good.
One of the ways I found that out is Michael Moore was kind enough to take me to Cuba for assessment and evaluation in Cuba. So in early March, I traveled there along with seven other Americans with Michael for the film.
And, I mean, are you confident that they gave you the right analysis?
Absolutely. I went to Cuba on nine separate prescription medications. I came home from Cuba on four. And it was an amazing process for me to go see a different form of medicine. Cuba has a lot of problems. There's a lot of issues in Cuba. I don't want to live in Cuba. And they're lovely people, and it's a lovely country. But one of the things that's not broken is health care. Everybody who needs health care gets it, and they don't have to pay for it, and you don't have to feel guilty. And that was a revelation for me. I've never felt that. We've spent 20 years fighting for health care for ourselves. At the same time, when you're catastrophically ill, it's wrong. And I think the main reason that we're in the film is not because we're unique. It's because we're not unique. It's unsadly.
Do you think the solution is universal health care?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, single-payer universal health care. I can't see any other way that we're going to remove the profit margins from health. And so long as there's profit associated with it, people are going to get stuck in the middle of it, and they're going to get hurt.
Well, Donna Smith, Larry Smith, I wish you a long life and good health.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming here on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. Keep the pressure on health care. A lot of people in this position are hurting too badly to even get out there and speak. And on a movie screen in Manhattan on Monday night, I regained my dignity. And I'm counting on the rest of you to give back the dignity to millions of people like me who don't have it right now. Thank you.
Very, very powerful. Thank you very much. Larry, you want to say something?
I just wanted to say one of the horrible things about this is not even shown in Michael Moore's movie, although he showed as much as he could. But I had gone to Mayo Clinic in 2004, assuming that I would have a job when I got back, and because they decided all of a sudden that they didn't want to keep me there as a disabled person working there, they went ahead and fired me.
And because you needed health care.
Well, I had already gotten it, and they didn't want anybody that was disabled.
How are you disabled?
I can't lift over 20 pounds, and I can't walk more than 200 feet because I have claudication.
And what's your job?
I was a cashier at a casino in Deadwood. Yeah, I was.
Did you need to carry more than 20 pounds to be a cashier?
Yeah, they had coin bags.
I see.
But I had worked it out for a solid year, and I'd filled out all the paperwork to make sure I had the job back when I came back from my operation, and they went ahead and fired me.
Unfortunately,
so
as your wife said, it's
personal.
It's not, your story is not unique. I mean, your individual situation is, but this is happening all across the country. Thanks for coming on the air and sharing your story.
You.
I want to hear from Melinda Moskowitz. Now, she is a registered nurse. She is with the California Nurses Association, fighting for health care for Americans, and actually an organization that did an amazing thing. They took down a popular governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger of California, and made the strong man say uncle, I guess it's fair to say.
Yes, we did. And I can tell you, that's what nurses are about, registered nurses, nurses from the California Nurses Association National Organizing Committee. Our patients come first, and anyone or anything that gets in our way of protecting our patients, we will not tolerate that.
What was the issue in California?
Well, the issue was that we had passed a long-needed patient-nurse ratio in California because of the lack of care that patients were getting in the hospital and the safety net. And when he became governor, he had taken, during his campaign. He took a lot of money from the hospital industry, the insurance companies, the HMO, and the pharmaceuticals. And so when he became governor, one of his first acts was to freeze the improvement in the nurse-to-patient ratios on a med-surg unit where the majority of the patients are. And so that was an attack on our patients. But also he was at a convention that had women to celebrate women. And we were there with our banners to say, hands off our ratios. And he said to the audience of thousands of people that don't pay attention to those people over there. They don't like me because I'm always kicking their butts.
And you basically took your case to the people of California, and I think in a proposition, am I right, you got him beaten, something like that.
Well, yeah, he had a lot of propositions that were going to really take the safety net away from firefighters and their families and teachers and then our patients of California. And we did a coalition of those groups and just the community, and they were outraged, and we took them down.
Now Melinda, why are you here? Are you helping to promote the movie Sicko?
Absolutely. We're working with Michael Moore.
What have you done with regard to the film?
Well, we're out there. I mean, because...
Supporting the film. The California Nurse Association has endorsed the film.
Has endorsed the film, and we've actually working with Michael Moore, and we have for many, many months. But as registered nurses, we see on a daily basis the effects of our broken healthcare system. And
when you say you see the effects, lack of care, lack of money for care, people being forced out of hospital beds, what are we talking about?
Denial of patient care from the insurance companies. Imagine you have a wife or a mother that comes into the hospital and she has cancer and she has surgery to remove the cancer and she has drains coming from those wounds with blood, and in less than 24 hours the insurance company industry is saying that patient has to go home. They haven't even had the opportunity to grieve their loss and deal with the cancer, or have the education to really care for themselves while they're there. But the insurance industry says that they're well to go home. That is outrageous. You have people that are denied care, that have insurance. You have people that, you know, are tied to a job that they don't want to stay at, and
in order to keep their health insurance.
Yes. They don't. And you know, this is, you know, Donna and Larry's story we see on a daily basis. And we are absolutely unrelentless, and we are not going to stop until the insurance companies are out of the health care because they're denying care. And until we remove them from our health care system, more people are going to die, more people are going to be denied. And the only solution is a single payer.
Universal health care.
Universal health care.
Now, some say, well, if that happens, people won't get to choose their own doctors.
Oh, that is totally inaccurate. I mean, you know, and I think what we're hearing is people, the hospital industries, insurance companies, pharmaceuticals, and a lot of people in power want to scare the community, so they say you won't be able to choose your doctor. That is totally inaccurate.
The famous Harry and Louise commercials that took down Hillary Care in the 1990s.
The truth is that every citizen will be able to choose the physician they want. They can choose the hospital they want. You won't have the insurance industry dictating to the physicians what kind of care the patients are going to get, what procedures they're going to get. This is something that we need. And it's kind of like, you know, in your home, you know, you have termites. You have to get rid of every one of them. This incremental plan that you hear a lot is not going to work. Because if you don't get rid of the total termites, they're going to come back, and they're just going to grow and grow and grow. And that's what the insurance industry is.
Now, how do you answer the people that say, well, but, you know, in America, for the rich, if you can pay for care, we should be able to pay for, you know, the best care possible?
If you're rich, yeah, they do. But, you know, we have to get away from being a society about, it's about me. We're the only country that...
We're the only industrialized country that doesn't have universal health care.
Absolutely.
Canada, France,
absolutely.
Britain, I mean, any other
absolutely.
Country I can think of.
And Michael Moore's movie, Sicko, really illustrates what's happening on a daily basis in our country. And we have to start thinking about everyone else. You know, you hear about this, you know, it's socialized medicine. You know, we have a lot of socialized programs. We
Social Security, Medicare.
Social Security, firefighters.
Public education.
The police department, our libraries. And can you imagine if your house is on fire and a fire truck comes up and the fire are coming to try to put out your fire and they're going to ask you, do you have insurance?
You know what, Melinda? It used to be that way.
Yes,
I have to tell you
yes.
this. I live in Alexandria, Virginia. And right close to the old town, the old colonial neighborhood. And if you look there in Alexandria or Philadelphia or Boston or any very old city, Charleston, mm-hmm. you see on the homes there are plaques for various fire companies. And there are different fire companies you belong to. And the way it worked in colonial periods is if your house was on fire, the fire truck would come out. If you had your insurance plaque, then what they would do is they'd save your house. And if you didn't, they wouldn't. But what they would do is if the house next to you, and these are all townhouses, was burning down, if you paid your insurance, they would carefully put the flames just on the border to protect the home that paid the insurance.
Exactly.
And I'm afraid that's sort of where our health care is right now.
Absolutely. And is that what we want? Is that what we want for our mothers or our wives or our children?
For anybody.
You know?
Thank you very much for coming on The Inside Scoop.
I hope you enjoyed those interviews. That, by the way, is true. People don't even know what they are. It's funny. I was explaining to someone who was coming through Alexandria the other day. But in any old city in America, or I presume England as well, you go through and you see those plaques, and you better have that plaque on the wall, because if you went with a insurance company that went out of business, then your house would burn down and they would come and protect your neighbor's house. There's one last chance to call in, Malone, if you want to call back. I'd love to hear from you. 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Talking about affirmative action, or health care, or anything else in the news. You know, today we had Harriet Myers refused to talk. Sarah Taylor refused to talk. It's amazing, really. It seems the President of the United States thinks that Congress has no role whatsoever to play. And yet Article 1 in the Constitution is about the Congress. If you read our Constitution, you realize that Congress is the most important branch. President is second, and the courts third. Of our three branches, and it seems like this stonewalling by the president, it's really an insult, I think, to all of us who believe in the checks and balances of the Constitution. I'll give you one last chance to call in, 888-488-6275, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. You know, as I talk with people, when I talk with fellow progressives, when I watch the Michael Moore movie Sicko, when I watch this president refuse to allow anyone to talk to his aides, it just strikes me that there's a huge basic human difference between the way a progressive approaches his or her country, his or her problems, and the way that a conservative ideologue does. There is, of course, no such thing as compassionate conservatism. All the compassion, it seems, is gone out of the word. That word is an oxymoron, compassionate conservative. But progressives, I think, realize, particularly as you look at movies like Michael Moore's movie, and the people of England and the people of France and the people of Canada and those good people in the United States, is we're all on this planet together. And we all can help each other. We all have an obligation, I think, to do something to help each other. And it seems the conservatives, it reminds me of the two-year-old that goes running around the house, mine, 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 mine. And I'm not saying that there can't be inefficiencies or that you know, the government always does the right thing. And listen, the government often does the wrong thing when you've got incompetent leaders in control. That's why you need people watching the government, seeing what they're doing. That's why you need oversight. That's why the president should obey Congress when they want to find out what's going on. But in essence, it's just at the heart of the matter. It's the people who were born on third base think they hit a triple. That's a conservative. And a progressive, no matter where you're born. In fact, sometimes I think it's wild that the people pick on John Edwards because he's made a lot of money. I mean, he grew up in a poor family. He's made a lot of money. Good for John Edwards. That's okay. It's okay to be rich in America. It's okay that John Edwards has expensive haircuts. It's okay that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was rich, as was John F. Kennedy, because they used their money, they used their talent. Someone like John Kerry, a very wealthy man, hasn't forgotten the poor. There's nothing wrong with being rich. Sometimes people, conservatives, make liberals feel like we hate the rich. But what a progressive understands is that just because you have lots of money does not make you a better human being, does not make you better than anyone else. And when it comes down to the right to live, the right to live, the right to get cancer treatment, the right to get your finger back if it's cut off in a buzzsaw, do we really think that only the rich should get health care? Is that really the kind of America we believe in? Do we really not see that much poorer countries than us do care for all their citizens? I don't like to think of Americans that way. I think of Americans as places with bake-offs and, you know, where they raise money for each other and you know, the old Christmas special where Jimmy Stewart, It's a Wonderful Life, he's in trouble and his neighbors tune in and help him out. That's the America I like to think of. It's obviously the America that Republicans hate the most. The ones they hate the most. Oh, I just found out Radin was on the line and I didn't know. Yikes. Radin, okay, go ahead. Take 30 seconds. Go.
Okay, Mark, thanks.
I'm sorry, I didn't see you were on the line. Give me your best 30 seconds.
Run. Okay, here we go. We've got a few days till the 15th when the internet royalty rates take over and music on the web may be going down. So that's my call to action for the day along with everything else. And I don't think Mel Watt was being at all unparliamentarian this morning, and I liked his words in the committee.
I've always liked him. I think he's great.
I even.
Radin, thanks for calling in. Next time, call in a little bit earlier, all right?
I will.
But she's absolutely right on that. We have to protect internet neutrality. Listen to Radin. That's all for me. I'll see you next week. This is Mark Levine signing off.
This is the Quality News Network. A House committee will pursue contempt charges against former White House counsel Harriet Myers after following the president's directive and not showing up for a hearing on the firings of federal prosecutors. The president invoked executive privilege, thus freeing Myers of making any testimony. The president said today during a press conference the interim progress report on the Iraq war is cause for optimism. The document shows Baghdad has met 8 out of 18 benchmarks, but has failed on another 8, with two goals having mixed results. President Bush said the U.S. mission can succeed in Iraq, adding troops will be withdrawn when conditions warrant it. The president also commented on the commutation of Louis Scooter Libby's prison sentence, saying it was a, quote, fair and balanced decision. President Bush said today he is sending Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Robert Gates to the Middle East next month. The two will attempt to strengthen international support for democracy in Iraq. The latest intelligence report says al-Qaeda has restored its operating capabilities to its strongest since 9/11. According to a U.S. counterterrorism analyst, the terrorist group has utilized its safe haven along the Afghan-Pakistan border and has repositioned itself to better attack the West. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog group, has reached an agreement with Iran regarding how to proceed with negotiations over the state's nuclear activities. The agreement comes soon after Tehran's cooperation in scaling back its uranium enrichment program. That program, if not fully suspended, may lead to further UN sanctions. Former Newark Mayor Sharp James was indicted on corruption charges today for allegations involving land sales and improper use of city-issued credit cards. The 71-year-old faces 33 counts of fraud for approving the sale of city-owned land to a female companion at below-market prices. The indictment also cites the use of city credit cards for funding vacations with 8 women in the U.S. and South America. It is reported that James has turned himself in to the FBI. South Dakota's first execution in 60 years was held last night. A 25-year-old Texas man was put to death by lethal injection for the torture and murder of a 19-year-old during a home robbery. Funeral services are pending for First Lady Lady Bird Johnson following her death yesterday in Austin, Texas. She was 94. You're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business, next.
If you're a news junkie, there's a book you must read called Don't Mess with the Press, How to Write, Report, and Produce Quality Television News. Don't Mess with the Press is a textbook for journalism students and a handbook for people already in the business. While written primarily as an instructional guide, Don't Mess with the Press is also useful for people who follow the news closely, who want to understand how news decisions are made by quality reporters to ensure they get the best news coverage possible. Don't Mess with the Press was written by Tony Seaton, founder and executive producer of the Quality News Network. Tony began his broadcast journalism career in his teens, eventually covering Watergate, 6 elections, 5 space shots, and a wide range of general news. He also produced Barbara Walters news interviews for ABC. Ordering information for Don't Mess with the Press can be found at qualitynewsnetwork.com. Visit our website and click on the Don't Mess with the Press link.
An investigation will begin in the disappearance of $22 million in computers and other equipment from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the last 3 years, there have been 61 investigations into the disappearance of CDC property, none of which resulted in disciplinary action. Florida's governor is poised to sign an executive order requiring stricter greenhouse gas emissions from automobiles. His legislation would also raise energy standards on new construction and force utilities to generate 20% of their power from renewable sources. A dozen scientists in a 41-foot raft made of reeds and wooden planks have set sail on a trip from New York to Spain. The journey, which is expected to take 2 weeks, is attempting to prove that Stone Age sailors could have made a similar voyage. 92% of Americans favor labels on food revealing the product's country of origin. That's according to a poll by Consumer Reports magazine.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
This is the Quality News Network. Taliban leaders claim they have killed a South Korean hostage, one of 23 Christian aid workers abducted by Islamic militants, because the Afghan government let a deadline pass without releasing Taliban prisoners from its jails. The report remains unconfirmed until a body is provided. Afghan officials say intelligence reports indicate that 2 hostages may have been killed. 10 Afghans working for a U.S. security company were killed in an ambush today in southern Afghanistan. The attack occurred on the same highway on which those South Koreans were kidnapped more than a week ago. In his first official meeting with President Bush as Britain's prime minister, Gordon Brown reaffirmed today his country's continuing military presence in Iraq. Meantime, the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq says a large contingent of troops will be needed in the country until mid-2009. If that timeline is kept, that means the Iraq war would pass to President Bush's successor.
Today, the Pentagon announced three U.S. soldiers have been killed during combat operations in the Anbar province. A car bomb in a Baghdad market killed six people today and wounded 12. 52 other Iraqis died in sectarian attacks today throughout the country. As many as seven people were killed and 50 wounded by stray bullets when thousands of Iraqis took to the streets to celebrate the country's soccer victory in the Asian Cup tournament. Iraqi Parliament adjourned for the month of August today. A report released by the U.S. Inspector General monitoring Iraqi reconstruction, highly critical of the government's management of funding and projects. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Chief Robert Gates head to the Middle East today to hold a series of talks with allies meant to help improve security. The two also bring governments there billions of dollars in military aid deals. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinians who fled during battles between Hamas and Fatah weeks ago began returning to their homes today. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asked for Russia's support in his feud with rival faction Hamas for control over the Palestinian territories. Former San Francisco 49er head coach Bill Walsh died of leukemia today at the age of 75. Late-night talk show host Tom Snyder also passed away in San Francisco yesterday. Snyder was 71. A look at science and business news just ahead.
What are you doing?
Fertilizing the lawn. Do you want to help?
No, not really. But didn't you just do that last week?
Yeah, I did. I want the lawn to be really lush and green this year.
Dad, what happens when those sprinklers go on?
We give the grass a good long drink.
That water runs off with the fertilizer in it and gets into the bay, working on the fish.
So what should I do?
Use just the minimum recommended amount. The lawn will be just as green and you'll be saving our ocean.
Taking care of the marine sanctuary is your duty. From Mayos at Monterey High.
Hello, I'm CHP Officer Felix Isarras. Law enforcement officers throughout the state are committed to removing drunk drivers from California roadways before they kill or injure themselves, or worse, an innocent victim. Right now, local law enforcement and the CHP are conducting DUI checkpoints to find drunk drivers and keep California roads safe.
Always designate a sober driver. And if you see a drunk driver on the road, call 911. A message from the Office of Traffic Safety and California Highway Patrol.
Diabetes drug Avandia should be pulled from the market, according to federal health officials. The drug has been linked to an increased risk of heart attack. Researchers have identified two genes they think may increase the risk of contracting multiple sclerosis. It is the first major gene discovery in the field in two decades. A controversial new study released yesterday in London says global warming is contributing to an increase in the number and ferocity of Atlantic hurricanes. Number of hurricanes per season has doubled over the last 100 years. Sara Lee recalling 27 whole wheat flour products because they may contain small bits of metal. Most of the products distributed across the southern states under 13 different brand names. Defense contractor Lockheed Martin announced a 34% surge in quarterly profit fueled by revenues earned as a result of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Northwest Airlines canceled more than 500 flights over the weekend in a dispute with pilots who say they're being asked to fly too many hours a month. Federal restrictions mandate 1,000 flying hours annually. Light sweet crude oil trading at $76.83. That's down 19 cents. At the close of Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 92 points at 13,358. NASDAQ up 21 points. S&P 500 up 15. There's more at our website, qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Barbara Lewis.
Head On is brought to you every night by the West Virginia District Council of Carpenters and Millwrights. Union Carpenters and Millwrights, they're building the American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it, so call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. broadcasting live from the Head On Radio Network office sauna. I am Bob Kincaid. Now, there are some things even air conditioners can't do anything about, and the two windows face the where the studio is face the south and the west, and just throw another little bit of water on the rocks. Full warm, just a little bit warm, but we'll get through it. And when, you know, this is pretty doggone hot conversation radio anyway, so it's going to heat up the room by itself, right? Sure. Now, what's on tap for tonight? Well, here, even as I speak, we are preparing for our first interview of the evening. And look, I got to tell you, I'm excited about this. I'm excited about all our interviews. I won't bring an interview to you unless it is something that I feel like is worth not the interviewee's time, but your time. Because time is, as I have noted on a number of occasions, the single most finite resource on this planet. I don't get any more of it. You don't get any more of it. It's why I get so mad. It's why I don't suffer fools gladly, quite frankly. It's what makes ignorant people so tough to deal with, because you know they're taking your time of which you're not getting any more. And so it's almost become a truism after any frustrating experience in our family that the response after said frustrating experience, "Now, honest to God, this is real live USDA choice beef. It come all the way from Nebraska. I got it on special on the freezer on the back of my truck. I can sell you two boxes for the price of one." No, thank you. Or, you know, if you become the Jehovah's Witness, you may have a chance to be one of only 140,000 Jehovah's Witnesses to actually make it into heaven. And you say, no, thank you. No, please, no. And eventually you close the door and you say, "Well, there's another 15 minutes of my life that I'll never get back." So I try to keep that kind of thing in mind when I schedule interviews. And I did not expect to get this interview. I wrote away and I wrote away. I sent in two box tops. I wrote the management team for this individual, this gentleman, this icon, and politely asked for an interview. And lo and behold, I think it's going to happen. Agnes should probably be dialing the phone even as I speak now. And toward that, what it boils down to is we're going to be joined in a few minutes, as soon as Agnes dials the phone number, by literally a rock and roll icon, Al Stewart. Al was there in the early days. He met the Beatles. He shared a boarding house with Paul Simon in the early days. Jimmy Page. Dig this, Jimmy Page was a session musician for Al. Of course, he's had many of his own hits over the years. But the thing that fascinates me most about Mr. Stewart is his perspective. He has a profound ability to and a love for history and culture, and an ability to see the past through present eyes. And because of that, and because of what we do on this program, I felt like it would be an excellent opportunity to get perspective from places we wouldn't ordinarily get it. Now, we talked with our new friend Will Kimbrough last night. Will offered Southern perspective on the war, on the direction this nation is taking. And so I'd like to get a different perspective this time through from a man with a profound ability to see through the fogs and mists of time. We're joined at this time by Mr. Al Stewart. Al, are you with us?
Yeah. Hi, I'm here.
What a pleasure it is to talk to you, first of all. Thank you very kindly for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
I wrote off to your management team because I was sitting up late one night, and I had your 24 Carats album on.
Okay.
And this was as the conflagration in Lebanon and Israel was breaking out. And I was listening to Constantinople.
And yeah, that makes sense.
Well, maybe. God only knows what happens at 2 o'clock in the morning around here. But there was a line in there where you wrote, "It's like an old Greek tragedy held over by popular acclaim."
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, isn't it? I mean, going all the way back to the Trojan War, this has been going on for quite a long time, really. It's a wonderful story where Aeneas, the prince of Dardania, who was on the side of the Trojans, obviously, when Troy gets burned, Aeneas goes off and, after various travels and a romance with Dido, ends up founding the colony of Alba Longa in northern Italy, which, of course, becomes Rome. Now, the irony of all of this is that the descendants, some of them were even Aeneas' descendants, or the people who had traveled with him, go on to sack and destroy the Greek Empire 1,000 years later. So, even though the Trojans were defeated at the Siege of Troy, they 1,000 years later, they get their own back. And so with that in mind and with, all the other things that have gone since the Cyprus invasion and what have you, and then, of course, in 1453, the siege and conquest of Constantinople, I said, it's like an old Greek tragedy held over by popular acclaim, because it seemed as though history suggested that to be so.
Do you, Al? Do you think? I mean, is this and from your perspective, is this some sort of predestined sort of thing, or is this mainly the ignorance of the ignorance of fools that makes it happen again and again and again and again?
Well, I think it's fun, really. I mean, for the participants, it's sort of like American football. People don't do things that they don't want to do, you know. One of the things that seems to be ingrained in human nature is that we like to march off and fight wars. I mean, we always have done. I suppose it's a human instinct.
That's well, you know, from the 2000 Stanley Kubrick's 2001 with the chimpanzee standing with the bone in his hand next to the monolith. That would argue in favor of your position.
Well, it's not just my position. It's the position of humanity for at least the last 6,000 years and probably for, you know, several million prior to that. I mean, I can't think. Actually, oddly enough, I'm standing here. I was born in 1945, and this is the longest period of peace without a major war that I can think of, really, certainly for my country. I mean, I don't really count all these, you know, fooling around in South America things that we've done. I mean, it's... you know, without a full-scale European conflict, what is it, 60 years now? I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
And it would seem almost that Europe has gotten past it, and maybe the United States is moving into the birth pangs of empire. I think in a number of places you've lit some lights and put some perspective on things that we ought to be paying attention to. There's a thread, and I don't want to sit here and play critic or play your records backwards or anything. But a number of times, you've reflected on sort of the skullduggery or the mystical or mysterious qualities in what would seem to be circumstances of totalitarianism, Night Train to Munich, even the mysticism surrounding Year of the Cat. Is there something that is at work, or is there something? Is there a special appeal for you in those situations? The Running Man, where someone has to operate against those kinds of overwhelming odds.
Yeah, I mean, these songs, all the songs you've just mentioned, and a lot of my other songs for that matter. I mean, basically, they're cinema. I conceive them as movies, you know. So I'm looking for, you know, plot and character development and a whole lot of things that aren't really in popular music. I mean, I'm thinking of them as like, thinking of these songs as mini movies, really. I mean, Running Man is, you know, it's a movie about chasing Nazis around South America. I mean, I write these things because no one else seems to. But I have always liked history.
How did you make a conscious decision to carve that niche for yourself?
Well, I did look around one day and noticed that there were no historical folk rock singers in the world, and I thought, I wonder if there's, you know, room for one of one to make a living. And that was about 35 years ago when I released Past, Present, and Future. And I don't know, people loved it. I mean, when I say people loved it, I mean, you know, sort of 0.1% of people loved it. But actually, if you add them all together, it is just about enough for one historical folk rock singer to make a living, and I've done it ever since, so I'm proof of that.
And apparently it supports a pretty nice wine cellar from what
yes,
I read.
Yes, it does. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like I get paid like a doctor, I suppose, you know, so I don't get rich, but I can make a living, and I can drink Chateau Margaux every now and then, so life can't be too bad. But, you know, I keep expecting someone else to break into it, but the people are so... people want, especially when you're young, you want sort of rapid success, and you want it to be on a grand scale. I mean, I just can't really see, Justin Timberlake writing Road to Master, because it would just take too long for him to become successful doing that. It's just, you know, so much easier to make dance music and, you know, get your face on the front cover of People magazine. And I resigned to the fact after 40 years that, you know, writing Roads to Moscow or Lord Granville or On the Border or any of these other songs that I've written is never going to get my face on the cover of People magazine. But as I say, I mean, my basic reason for doing all this is because I like these songs, and if I didn't write them, no one else would.
Well, it strikes me that there's also a great deal of reading involved. And for the people out there who are desperately trying to get their faces on the cover of People magazine, there's a lot of human effort involved in staying in front of cameras. Obviously, you've done a tremendous amount of reading. Do you set off on a project, or are you more just of a sort of smorgasbord absorber of information?
Well, it depends what I'm writing. Now, Roads to Moscow was the most complicated one to research, and I think probably did read about 40 books to put together that song. I mean, from the very obvious ones, the first thing I had to read was Guderian's memoirs, because I mentioned him in the song. I didn't want him in the wrong place.
Right.
And then I read Alexander Wirth's History of Russia at War. And, of course, William Shirer, that I think everyone has read, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And then little things for color, The Deserted House by Ilya Chukovskaya. And I think some Arthur Koestler is in there, too. And then I thought, well, we better get the views from the opposition. So I read Zhukov's memoirs, and that was a nice balance with Guderian's. And I put it all together, and eventually I had this song. Of course, the kernel of the song is a book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn called One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich. And that basically is that's the bones of the song. I was in some ways following Solzhenitsyn's capture and imprisonment as the main storyline of the song. Now, I hasten to add that all this research is not something I would dream of doing for, you know, sort of most of the songs that I write. It's just that I think Roads to Moscow is an exaggerated case where I'd read most of these books before I even started writing the song, and then I just wanted to get color and detail, so I read a few more.
Well, you know, I have such respect for your range and your interests. I think you still exist as the only rock and roller who has ever written a song about the Sirens of Titan.
Well, probably. I mean, but that one's pretty obvious because that's a Kurt Vonnegut novel.
Mm-hmm.
I went through a period of liking Kurt Vonnegut a lot. I think I read about the first 9 books that he wrote, and then I don't know, somewhere along the line I thought I've read so many of these things that you know, I can pass on to something else now.
Well, one of the songs that, and frankly, we've bumped in and out of segments with it from time to time, Al, is League of Notions.
Oh, yeah, well, I like that song.
I love that song because...
Well, that song is seems more prescient to me every day. It's just, It's supposed to be describing the Versailles Peace Conference of 1919, but you know, you can play that song and then it seems like it's current. It's very weird, you know, because history does seem to repeat itself.
Well,
but I like the way that all these people come into that song, Clemenceau and
Lloyd George
and Lawrence of Arabia is even in there. I was thinking of Clemenceau the other day because he was. I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I don't have any information around me, but it seems to me that he was the mayor of Paris during the 1870 Paris Encirclement and Paris Commune. I don't know if that's true. Is that true? Do you know?
I believe he was around. You're talking about the time of the Franco-Prussian War.
Yes.
Yes.
I think he was the mayor of Paris. But anyway, whatever. By 1918, he was this little old gray-haired man, and he was you know, defending the French interest. And he said this wonderful thing about the American president, Woodrow Wilson, who arrived in Europe with 14 points to make the world safe. And Clemenceau was overheard to say in a very loud voice, "Even God only had 10." And these are just great quotes. You know, how can you resist putting something like that in a song?
Oh, without a doubt. And you know, one of the things that League of Nations points up is there was like a hubris involved in the carving up of Europe, the carving up of the Middle East, and you know, we're very progressive, liberal-oriented. We don't like George Bush very much on this program, Al. But the fact of the matter is that same sort of hubris and intransigence seems to be manifesting itself now in the Levant, in the form of this nation's unwillingness to try to step in and stop that slaughter.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, I mean, that America is obliged to start or stop wars anywhere in the world. I mean, it's a very famous line that George Will said about the first President Bush, which is one of my favorite things George Will has ever said. He wouldn't be one of your favorite people because he's
I read him,
conservative.
Though.
But this was a great comment. And he was talking about the first George Bush, and George Bush the first was saying, you know, what we need is a domestic czar, because he was spending so much time on foreign policy, he wanted someone to look after, you know, the home fires, as it were. And George Will wrote, "In the past, we had just such a man. He was called the president."
Exactly. And well,
that's such a wonderful line.
Well, Jimmy Carter, or no, I believe it was Senator Chuck Hagel, came out today, and it was something I had said on the program a couple of weeks ago. And he said, "Whoever it is, this time is calling out for a great statesman."
Well, yes and no. It's a lot. I think. Well, I don't know. What do I know? It seems a lot trickier. I mean, no one is asking Sweden or Peru to go and sort this out. And once you become the world's policeman, and possibly I say this because, you know, like 100 years ago, the British were in the same situation. Once you get yourself into that position, it's you're just stirring up trouble for yourself. I mean, you get to be the guy that everyone calls to, you know, go and put the fires out all over the world, and eventually everyone ends up hating you. I mean,
right.
The British got drummed out of everywhere after 1947, 48, and you know, probably justifiably too. But you get in this position by going in with goodwill and ending up owning the place. You know, so I'm not terribly sure that it's a good idea for, you know, sort of the great power of the day to act in this way. Also. I mean, again, you probably have the advantage of me. I'm doing this from memory, but doesn't the Atlantic Charter specifically forbid America from having an empire?
It sort of does, but then again, we signed the Geneva Conventions too.
Well, I'm not going to get into that.
I understand completely. Al, where is I noticed your tour schedule is incredibly busy these days. Is there an album out anytime soon?
Well, there was an album, I don't know if there was an album out last year, which is almost all historical. I liked it a lot.
We've been busy building this wee little network, and I did miss out on it. I saw the mention of it on your website.
I missed out on it entirely because it's probably still that there in the universe somewhere.
Right. Well, I intend to get my hands on it post haste.
Well, it's more in the past, present, and future mold. It's basically a historical record, although it's I don't know. It's not so in your face, really, as PPNF. But Touring, yes, oddly enough. I mean, for someone who's written so many World War II songs, I'm off to do, as you've probably seen, 11 shows in Germany later in the year, which is always an interesting situation. I'm still occasionally able to make aging Nazis walk out on me, at least I was 20 years ago. I did the Road to Damascus thing, complete with slides. So we had, you know, Guderian and Hitler and Stalin and all these people were suddenly brought to life in a Munich concert hall, and it actually caused a bit of a kerfuffle, and several people walked out.
Oh, that's amazing.
But I think, I mean, for a rock star to be able to cause controversy is relatively easy, but for, a fairly humble folk singer with an acoustic guitar to drive people out of a concert hall is, I thought, something of a major achievement.
Well, and rather a badge of honor, too, really.
Well, yes, considering who I was driving at in all likelihood, I thought it was pretty damn good.
But obviously there was there's an interest in having you back there, and of course you'll be at the Royal Albert Hall in London later this year. And you're touring up and down the West Coast. There's some dates in New York and Pennsylvania that I've noticed. I take it that touring is something that is still very important to you.
Well, I got to make a living.
Well, that too, but...
It's, you get older and your fingers hurt a bit, and touring is very difficult. Not the playing. The playing's easy, but the traveling is very difficult. And the more so. Just hauling equipment around. I mean, my suitcase weighs 57 pounds, and if you have to drag it up three flights of stairs in a boarding house every night, I mean, there's a point at which, you know, your back goes out and it hurts. And it basically, after a while, touring just physically hurts a lot. But I can't imagine not doing it because, it's what I do. If I didn't tour and play the guitar, I mean, I have no idea what I would do. I'd just look out of the window and just sort of watch the traffic go by.
Sit around and read books.
Well, you can read books. I always read books, but you have to physically get out and do things.
Well, and it's a real goodness for your fans as well because just enough to support one rock and roller, but the fan sites out there on the web for you, Al, are really quite dedicated.
After a while you become this sort of cult thing, which is a polite way of saying that the mainstream have never heard of you. but I think in a way, what happens is the people who follow the more obscure artists tend to be a lot more dedicated to them. You know, the people who follow Richard Thompson or Tom Waits or, Nick Drake's not with us anymore, but you know what I mean? These kind of people, they tend to be pretty devoted, whereas people who follow Britney Spears, you know, do it one week and then the next week it's Avril Lavigne, you know?
True.
Whereas, you know, if you're a Richard Thompson fan, you're a Richard Thompson fan forever. You know, it never goes away.
Well, I was looking at your fan websites and so forth, and it struck me that your fan, of which I am one, let me say. I mean, I got my copy of Year of the Cat in seventh grade, Al, and I've still got it. Your fans strike me as sort of, in a way, a more literate version of Jimmy Buffett's parrot heads, if you will.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And, of course, they're only about, you know, sort of one-tenth of 1% of the fans that Jimmy Buffett has. But I think they are. I mean, we've got a lot of English teachers and a lot of history professors that turn up at my gigs. And, you know, they're forever correcting my grammar and pointing out my mistakes. And I like that. I mean, it's wonderful, you know.
Well, I love the directions that, speaking from a personal standpoint, that you took me, because I had never heard of Ernst Röhm, and I went and I read about Ernst Röhm after hearing The Last Days of June, Last Day of June 1934.
Ah, well, Ernst Röhm's an interesting character.
Oh, absolutely.
In the great sweep of history, it doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot, but The Last Day of June 1934 basically cemented Hitler in power, so the night meant a lot. Interestingly enough, it was the other people he killed on that night, but some of which were perhaps more important, Gregor Strasser being one of them, who was stupid enough to believe in the socialist aspect of National Socialism and paid for that with his life. And Hitler got rid of, well, an old girlfriend, and who else did he get rid of? He got rid of, I think, one of his school teachers who'd given him bad marks in math. I mean, it's, when you look at the list of the 2,000 people who were killed, on June 30th, 1934. There are some remarkable people on, like the Hitler, I think, probably personally put on the list. Ernst Röhm is top of the list because he was, you know, the leader of the Brown Shirts.
And a danger to Himmler.
Well, I think it was more of a danger to... Well, I don't know. Ernst Röhm had this sort of idea in his head that he was perhaps more important in the grand scheme of things than Hitler wanted him to be. And the Brown Shirts were completely out of control. I mean, they were a rabble, and Hitler didn't want a rabble. He wanted an army, so... he sent the SS after them, and everyone knows what happened next.
And, you know, and just another example, I found out about Nostradamus from you.
Wow.
And
well, Erika Cheetham, who was the great-granddaughter of a viceroy of India, wrote three books about Nostradamus, all of which sold very well. I met her when she was writing the first of them. And so I had access to, she had her galleys all over her apartment, and I was just wandering around saying, okay, you know, what did he say that was really interesting? And she was, you know, offering me all these quotes. And I basically just assembled a whole bunch of them and stuck them into a song. And that song, I don't know. I don't know if I believe any of it, you see, myself. But people latched onto it, as they do, to mysterious and slightly outre things.
Well, I'll hazard a guess that there are a lot of people who... had never heard of Riyadh until you merged Nostradamus and the world goes to Riyadh, and of course,
immediately after that the world did go to Riyadh.
Yeah, well, you know, and I stayed at a Holiday Inn there last night. That the whole world is in Riyadh right now.
That is so crazy. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it's spooky because you write something in it, and immediately it comes to pass. But I don't think there's any big deal about that. I think the kind of things that I write songs about, I mean. They're as likely to go the way that I suggest as not, you know. There are some things, I mean, on the border, you know, I was talking about the Rhodesian crisis as it was then and the Basque separatist movement that appears to have just got settled and the decline and fall of the British Empire. And I just didn't think that Rhodesia was going to be a place that would work. And, of course, Stevie Wonder had a song out at the same time where he declares peace will come to Zimbabwe. And as it happens, he was wrong. But on the border, when I play it, it still appears to be pretty accurate.
It does indeed. And, of course, old admirals. I'm not exaggerating when I say that lines from your songs run through my head. I was watching CNN the other day and saw one of these CNN military analysts, General so-and-so retired, and old admirals went running through the back of my brain.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was based on the life of Jackie Fisher, Sir John Fisher,
right.
Who was the first Sea Lord in 1914.
Shuffled out of the way by Winston Churchill.
And for no good reason, too, because it was after the Gallipoli campaign, which was actually Churchill's idea. I think Fisher was against the idea, but Fisher got the blame for it, and he was shuffled out of the way, as you say, and he never came back. But Fisher was actually responsible for the dreadnought.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that I don't think there was a single dreadnought sunk from the British Navy in the whole of World War One, although there was only one significant naval engagement, which was Jutland, but they never lost the dreadnought. So maybe Fisher was right about it after all.
It spoke well for him, and were he living in this age, he would have a comfy job as an analyst for the BBC or CNN or Fox.
Yeah. You know what? I can't see him doing that. He was an interesting character. He was like dancing on the deck of the ship. I mean, it was. And he'd come out in the evening and just do these amazing dances. I just can't see.
Well, he transitioned through a fascinating period in the British Navy because he literally did start out under sail.
Yes, he did, on the old Calcutta. It was not in 1853, as I said in the song, because I was looking for a rhyme. It was actually in 1854.
But
yes, he did.
To see that and go from that to coal-fired or oil-fired steamships. It must have been a mind-boggling transition for him.
Well, it was. That was mind-boggling time. I mean, there was a point around the 1890s when the torpedo, became a significant weapon, where the British Navy realized that, their gunnery range was, 1,000 yards or whatever, and the torpedo you know, had a range of 2,000 yards, and what this effectively meant was that the entire British fleet was obsolete. So Fisher's answer to this was to build these, you know, sort of enormous great floating tin cans with huge guns that could fire shells about 18 miles, and that really was the end of that, you know.
And that takes some vision.
Fisher's first, he had three laws, and I can't remember them now, but they, one of them was absolutely magnificent. They were very similar.
This is the Quality News Network. Taliban leaders claim they have killed a South Korean hostage, one of 23 Christian aid workers abducted by Islamic militants because the Afghan government let a deadline pass without releasing Taliban prisoners from its jails. The report remains unconfirmed until a body is provided. Afghan officials say intelligence reports indicate that two hostages may have been killed. 10 Afghans working for a U.S. security company were killed in an ambush today in southern Afghanistan. The attack occurred on the same highway on which those South Koreans were kidnapped more than a week ago. In his first official meeting with President Bush as Britain's prime minister, Gordon Brown reaffirmed today his country's continuing military presence in Iraq. Meantime, the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq says a large contingent of troops will be needed in the country until mid-2009. If that timeline is kept, that means the Iraq war would pass to President Bush's successor. Today, the Pentagon announced three U.S. soldiers have been killed during combat operations in the Anbar province. A car bomb in a Baghdad market killed six people today and wounded 12. 52 other Iraqis died in sectarian attacks today throughout the country. As many as seven people were killed and 50 wounded by stray bullets when thousands of Iraqis took to the streets to celebrate the country's soccer victory in the Asian Cup tournament. Iraqi Parliament adjourned for the month of August today. A report released by the U.S. Inspector General monitoring Iraqi reconstruction, highly critical of the government's management of funding and projects. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Chief Robert Gates head to the Middle East today to hold a series of talks with allies meant to help improve security. The two also bring governments there billions of dollars in military aid deals. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinians who fled during battles between Hamas and Fatah weeks ago began returning to their homes today. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas asked for Russia's support in his feud with rival faction Hamas for control over the Palestinian territories. Former San Francisco 49er head coach Bill Walsh died of leukemia today at the age of 75. Late night talk show host